The Centre for Stories is a place where stories are told, shared, and kept. This recording is from a special event with Graeme Simpson, an event presented in partnership with Autism West and Tex Publishing, held at the Centre for Stories in Northbridge, Western Australia, on 17th of April 2019. It features author Graeme Simpson in conversation with Elias Jocelyn.
So, hello, Graeme. My name is...
Elias,
yeah.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk. It is a pleasure to have this opportunity to meet with you. And congratulations on the completion of the Rosie trilogy.
Thank you very much. I've got to tell you, it's a very good feeling to get it done. People say, do you, are you going to miss these characters? And I say, I might get to that eventually, but right now I'm just pleased to have it done.
Trust me, they'll always be in you. So, for those members of the audience, it's you guys, who haven't had the chance to read the whole of the trilogy, me included, Can you please provide a brief summary of the storyline?
All right, starting from the first one, we meet Don Tillman, a socially inept professor of genetics, who I think everyone in this room would recognise as being someone on the spectrum. Everyone except possibly me back in 2013 when I was, well, in 2007 when I started writing the book, because Don, for me, was just one of those sorts of guys that I'd worked with. People say, how much research did you do in autism? And I say, 30 years in information technology. I just, and the radio club and studying physics and all that sort of stuff. I just hung out with lots of guys who were like Don, and that word, autism or Asperger's back then, just wasn't in my head when I wrote it. But okay, we've got a socially awkward genetics professor who's 39 years old and decides it's time to get married. Why? Because research indicates that married men are happier and live longer. Well, who wouldn't want that? So Don scientifically sets out a 16-page questionnaire, double-sided, to find the right woman and to eliminate, because Don's never had a second date. Something's always gone wrong, so he's going to eliminate all the women who've given him grief in the past. The homeopaths, the vegans, the people with religious beliefs, the late arrivers, the early arrivers, the whole lot. So he's got a 16-page questionnaire. He goes out and he meets a woman who is totally unsuitable, called Rosie. She smokes, she drinks, she arrives late, she's disorganised. It's a romantic comedy, you know what happens, okay? So end of the book, Don and Rosie are together. And at that point, traditionally there are no sequels to romantic comedies. So I had no plans to write a second book. But people were saying to me, hey, we don't believe this ending. We think that Don, essentially because Don is autistic, let's not mess around here, is not going to make a successful relationship. He won't be able to cope with emotions and human dynamics and so on. So it's a bit of a fanciful ending. And I was a bit peeved by this. So that motivated the Rosie effect, which was Don Tillman proving that he could see a marriage through and keep it together. And that great philosopher, Nancy Reagan, she once said, marriage is never 50-50, it's always 90-10. And a little nodding around the room for those who are married.
Whatever happened to 80-20?
Yeah, well, it might be 95-5. But I had, and so what I wanted to do in the book, there was no point showing Rosie, the neurotypical, helping Don through. It had to be the other way around. We had to see Don step up to the plate. So in the Rosie effect, I put Rosie under so much pressure that she's just falling apart. She's doing a Doctor of Medicine qualification in a strange city in New York, away from family and support. She's got to finish a PhD at the same time. Her PhD supervisor, the man she hates more than anybody else in the world, the evil Gene, is also Don's best friend. And he's come to live with him and he's staying up at night drinking with Don and leading him into temptation. Rosie is pregnant. And on top of that, Don has had some trouble with the law that he won't tell Rosie about, but she knows. Is there so? And people say to me, Rosie seems a bit edgy in this book. That's the point. So in that book, we see Don and Rosie's marriage survive. And at the end, typical ending to a pregnancy, they got a baby. And then the third book, I know it's a long, you're going to have that question, this number of questions, I can get to number three and I'll still be talking, so sorry about that a lot. But
it's only 12 questions.
Okay, good. Okay, 12. That's actually good help. It's a good guide, so we'll work with that. And in this third book, what people were saying to me, what we really want, because when we think autism, we think kids. And the general public very much associates autism with kids rather than with adults, and has traditionally at least. And they said, we want to see what it was like for Don when he was a kid. The trouble is that would have been set in the 1980s, when attitudes, knowledge were very, very different. It would not inform anything today. So I thought, what I'll do is I'll tell the story of Don's son, Hudson, who's facing exactly the same problems at school as Don did back in the day, but it's right now. So Hudson will be little Don. And Don will have to make a journey of his own, because Don, the school will say, we think an autism assessment might be in order. And Don's going to say, what? Autism? He's just a normal kid like me. I had all the same problems at school. All he needs is a little bit of help from his dad and everything will be fine. Because Don is in massive denial about his own possibility of being on the spectrum. So that set up a book for both of them to make a journey. And for a lot of comedy around the blind leading the blind, as it were. So that's, and I won't tell you how that story ends up, because look, I hope it ends up in a way that, that people in this room find really satisfying. And I know that most of the feedback I've had from the autistic community who have read the book and finished it, some of you may well, who's read the third book? Oh, well, there you go. Is it okay? Is it moderately satisfying? Okay, good, good. So they're the three books. There's your summary. And we're up to question, that was question one, wasn't it, or two?
Yeah.
It was question one. Okay.
We'd like to see a fourth.
We're going to sharpen these answers. Thanks. Thanks, Elias.
Okay, question two. Considering that Don is supposedly wired differently, his challenges are surprisingly common to all of our lives. Why do you think the storyline and characters, in particular Don, have such universal appeal?
Well, you know, the challenges that Don faces, exactly as you say, are the challenges we all face.
Yes.
Who hasn't, autistic or not, been out on a date and said the wrong thing? You know, who hasn't, it's just not on a date necessarily, just said, why did I say that? Who hasn't failed to read a situation and so forth? And I think, you know, I think one thing that appeals is people see that Don does this in spades. He really does screw up badly, and yet he comes out on top. He's okay. We realise in his decency and his sincerity and everything that this stuff doesn't really matter so much. Don doesn't dress so well. Nobody cares. They all love him. So I think there's a little bit that everybody can relate to the sort of mistakes in that Don makes, but also he's a great human being. He's decent. He's honest. He's always concerned to act ethically. And we see those strengths, and I hope that, you know, we look around us and say, wow, there's strengths around us that we don't even see sometimes.
Indeed. Question three. Don has taken us on some hilarious adventures. I didn't find them too hilarious when I read it. No, no offense, but sorry if that.
No, I'm coping with that all right. I just.
More wine for Graham.
All right.
Well, so, yeah, keep going, it's good.
All right, so some examples are the jacket incident.
Yeah.
On the first night he and Rosie went to dinner.
Yep.
That's the Rosie project.
Yep.
The suspected terrorist incident and the ensuing flight redirection back to New York, which I'm guessing is the second one.
Yep, you got it.
And then the arrest while researching child behaviour in the park, which might be the third one.
Still the second.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, we had a thing there. So where exactly did you get this inspiration for all these wonderful storylines?
Yeah, look, it's a funny thing. When you seek to write comedy, put it this way. I studied first as a screenwriter. If you ask me, could I write an episode of The Simpsons, I'll look at you straight and say, yes, I could. I could write an episode of The Simpsons that would stand up with the other episodes that had been written. You, arrogant pig, Graham. No, but I couldn't invent The Simpsons. It's a whole different level to have invented that idea, to have invented The Simpsons or to have invented Maxwell Smart or whatever it might be. And comedy comes out of great characters. And what I find is I can put Don Tillman into almost any situation and he will create comedy. And part of the reason is that he does the unexpected, because he's not neurotypical. He doesn't respond to some situations in the same way as a neurotypical person would do. Sometimes the way he responds is just way smarter than a neurotypical person. Go, Don, why did we all think of that? And sometimes it's way dumber. It's like, why didn't you see that, Don? And we, there's obviously a moral question here about, are we laughing at Don? And I have to be honest, sometimes we are. It's three people walking into a bar. The first two do something we expect, and the third one does something different. We know what the first two people are going to do, so we only need Don. He just comes in and does that different thing. And yes, we are laughing at him sometimes, and sometimes we're laughing at the people that he's got the better of, but he wins some, he loses some. The question I would always ask about whether I've been fair and reasonable, when you get to the end of the book, how do you feel about Don Tillman? Do you think he's someone that you respect, that you think he's a good person, that he's not someone you just laugh at for who he is? And I think that most people find that with Don, that he's a good person, they value him, they'd like to have him as a friend. Women write to me and say, I'd marry Don Tillman. So, and in some ways, that was the dilemma I wanted to give him in the first book. He's trying to succeed in love. Now, if he's trying to succeed in getting a job or something like that, we'd say, discrimination, that's not fair. But love, you're allowed to discriminate. So I wanted something where he absolutely had to come up and win it for himself. So, comedy is a funny thing. but comedy, really, of the kind I'm writing, largely comes out of character. And when I was writing all of these books, I'd sometimes have a scene that was hilarious, but in the end didn't really advance the story. And I would throw that scene away, knowing that whatever I replaced it with could still be funny because it had Don on it.
Okay. Question 4. Don has a passion, sound, i.e. thorough, knowledge, and obvious enjoyment for the finer things in life, like we enjoy fantastic food and the art of creating the ultimate beverage in particular. Does this stem from your own interest and passion in the elegant pastime of eating?
Okay, let's be honest. Don's a bit of a boozer. Don, I think, is on the edge, at least, of having a drinking problem. And one of the things that was interesting to me, I wonder where you got that from. So one of the things that a psychiatrist said to me, not long after the Rosie Project was published, he said, you know, you got Don dead right except for one thing. You got him drinking. And he said, in the language of the day, Aspies don't drink. And I said, and how do you know that? They teach you that in psychiatry? And he said, no, I got a patient who's an Aspie and he just will not touch alcohol. I said, yeah, I know plenty of people who are not Aspies who won't touch alcohol either. That, you know, there I'm coming from. But I got this sort of feedback sometimes that Don, but they typically a lot of Aspies don't drink. I said, well, Don's not typical of anything. Don is one human being. One part of his personality is that he's on the autism spectrum and he can drink or not drink. If you're telling me it's impossible to be on the autism spectrum and drink, then I'm going to stop him drinking. But I think that's true. So Don's love of booze probably has more to do with his love of alcohol than being a connoisseur. His interest in food, I think, is a somewhat technical interest in food. I don't know that he's a gourmet. I think he's a good cook, but his cooking is quite regimented and you know, he sees it as a practical discipline that he's approached in an unusual way. And his standardised meal system, that's the next Don Tillman book, by the way. The last Don Tillman book will be the standardised meal system. That came from a neurotypical person. It came from my former mother-in-law, my partner's mother, who had to bring up 4 kids by herself and didn't have time for anything much. So she said, right, yeah. Sunday night it's lamb, you know, Monday it's lamb rissoles and so on. And that was the same every week. The kids knew what to expect and everything was fine. So, and yet people look and say, oh God, Don is so autistic, they haven't standardised meal system. I think, no, people everywhere do. Or they say, why didn't I think of that?
So you never sort of drank in you... You weren't interested in drinking or...
Oh, me? I'm a wine nut. I'm a wine buff.
Right.
And I originally thought of making Don a wine nut, but I felt it was a bit too snooty, snobby for him. It just didn't fit Don. I thought cocktails just fitted his personality better, and it gave me a chance to learn about cocktails and drink a lot of cocktails as well.
Yeah. For research purposes.
Yeah. Entirely tax-deductibly. Okay, yeah. I'll tell you the truth. In one of my other books, The Best of Adam Sharp, I had a scene where he's in a cocktail, famous cocktail bar, the American bar at the Savoy Hotel in London. And each time I went to London, because I had to go there quite often for books, I'd go to there, I'd tax deduct the thing, you know, and so on, have cocktails, and just get this scene exactly right. And it was the last scene we dropped from the book.
Okay, I love this next one. As a writer, are you removed from your characters, or do you strongly latch on to them? Do you relate to them as being your friends and continue to write a story in your head despite the trilogy being complete?
You've got to immerse yourself in the story. You've got to be able to immerse yourself in every character. You've got to feel that everybody... I came out of screenwriting, and the classic question you're going to get from an actor is, what's my motivation? Why am I doing that? If you can't explain why everybody's doing what they're doing, you haven't really got a grip on the story. You can't say, because he's evil. Why is Gene cheating on his wife? Because he's a jerk. Well, yes, but why? What's he trying to prove? And I have this picture of Gene, for example, as someone who was a little like Don at school and got picked on, but he had a big thing to prove, that he could get the girls because he couldn't when he was young. And now at 50-something, he's busy being a serial philanderer just to do this. So... But you do get, I mean, you get to know your characters. All the characters got a little bit of me in them. I mean, people say, are you Don Tillman? I'm certainly not Don Tillman. But there's a bit of me in Don Tillman. The character who's most like me in all of the books that I've written is Hudson. But he's like 11-year-old me, not 60-something-year-old me. So he was the hardest, the biggest challenge of writing the book, and it turned out to be the easiest job because I just said put 11-year-old me into the story.
Right, so you keep these characters going like you make them up, but they're real to you.
It's a delicate thing. They're not... I can't say they're real. I don't miss them, but they behave... It's really hard to describe. It's a really good question because it's so hard to answer. Are my characters real to me? I can imagine them. I can imagine what they look like. I don't imagine particular actors playing them or anything like that, but there's a sense of them being human to me.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever seen Nim's Island?
No.
Well, it's a movie, and in the movie, there's a writer named Alexandra.
Yep.
And she writes these books, and the main protagonist in it is Alex Rover. Now, she sees Alex Rover, like, she sees him in her house. She sees what he looks like. She sees everything about Alex Rover, even though... he's a made-up fictional character in her books. So that's...
It's interesting, because I'm not a good visualiser.
Right.
I'm not even good at remembering faces. You know, I can walk out of here and someone say, so, you know, you were talking to Elias, what did he look like? Oh, God. Slim. What colour hair? Oh, God. Yeah, so I'm not good at that. And I probably couldn't tell you the colour of Jean's hair, but I have... So in that sense, I don't see them in a truly visual sense. I don't see them as... is physical manifestations, but I have a real sense of their presence.
Right.
So I have a sense of them conceptually. If they're in a conversation, it doesn't matter to me a lot what people look like. So that's not the essence. It's how they come across, what they would say, how they behave.
Yep. So, side note, Nim's Island, good movie.
Got it.
Watch it sometime.
Nim's Island.
All right. Question six.
Halfway. How are we doing here?
How are we doing here? How much time left?
It's all right. We'll give you the wind. I think we need to.
All right.
Okay. We just like now we were past halfway.
We've done six questions. Question six. The first time you mention autism is in The Rosie Effect. It wasn't, which I haven't read yet. It wasn't directly referenced in The Rosie Project, I agree. The focus on autism becomes stronger in each book. Why exactly have you sort of taken this approach?
Okay, so when I wrote The Rosie Project, I didn't even know Don was autistic. So he was just this guy, and I'm not a clinician, I did no research at a clinical sort of level about autism. My wife's a psychiatrist, and she didn't know much about it, which is not surprising. Psychiatrists and psychologists have not been great on this type, and there's improvement, I think, happening. But in the past, many, many people, I'm sure, went undiagnosed and were misdiagnosed with things like OCD, bipolar disorder, just straight depression, and so forth. So in that first book, and it was only towards the end as people started reading it and saying, well, obviously he's on the spectrum. And so I thought, I better at least acknowledge that I'm not so dumb that I didn't see that. So I put the Aspie Kids scene in there where Don speaks to a group of kids who are supposedly on the spectrum. They all end up standing up on the desks like something out of Dead Poets Society going, Aspie's rule, and that sort of thing. And he creates pandemonium.
Oh, yeah.
And afterwards, so it's not quite true that we don't mention it in the first book. Afterwards, Claudia, his psychologist friend, said, well, Don, you know, did you see anything that you recognised there? And I said, oh, yes, Laszlo Hevesi in the physics department. He is definitely... So in the second book, it was only a year later that I wrote the second book. I was still dubious about this. I'll tell you how Don gets diagnosed, actually, at some point. But in the Rosie effect, again, I wanted to just acknowledge that Don didn't identify as being on the spectrum. And so I have him at lunch with a psychiatrist who basically, and someone accuses him, not the psychiatrist, Lydia, of being on the spectrum in a not nice way. You know, like, oh, God, you said something tactless. What are you, Aspie or something? That sort of picture. Mm-hmm. And the psychiatrist, rather than saying, well, that would be all right, he says, well, Don, do you have a happy family life? Do you have a successful career? Do you have other problems? And now he says, no, this is good. He says, well, therefore you can't be on the spectrum because the DSM diagnostic criteria are looking at there being some form of deficit of not doing well in family life and professionally in your work or in some other aspect. And Don's all right. And it's a very psychiatric view that says he's not sick. What's the problem? So that's as close as we go in that book. And then in the third book, several years had passed. Oh, the diagnosis for Don, I was talking to Tony Atwood, who would be known to many people in this room, one day. I'd been invited to speak, be a keynote speaker at an Asperger's conference in Brisbane. So, I mean, I should be getting some feedback at this point that maybe Don was on the spectrum. But I said, yeah. And I said the same. Yeah, I hear people saying Don's on the spectrum. I don't know. I'm not a clinician. And Tony said, well, I am, and Don Tillman has Asperger's. So he was officially diagnosed by Tony Atwood. And we said, okay, so from then on, and then a lot changed in the last few years. I think everybody in this room would be aware. I would say the two huge things that I saw was the consolidation of autism and Asperger's and those tribes coming together rather than choosing to be separate. And the other was the rise of activism. On social media particularly, people coming out, being out and proud and activist about autism and pushing back on some of the traditional approaches, pushing back on the disease model and the deficit model and so on. And I felt I couldn't write a book now without acknowledging all of that. So in the third book, autism is front, centre and middle and top and bottom. It's on pretty much every page. That's the dramatic question. Is Hudson autistic? And, of course, we end up with a much more interesting story than just answering that question.
Question seven.
Yes. I'm going to go for a short one.
Four more to go. A lot has changed since the release of the Rosie Project with, thankfully, an increase in the awareness around autism, which I didn't even know. I didn't even know, your book was a life changer. In the Rosie Result, was it challenging to write a third novel that continues to be engaging whilst incorporating a serious theme and highlighting the inflexibility of society?
No.
Yeah, next question.
No, truth is, all the novels, I think, tackle serious themes. They tackle, the first novel tackles identity, acceptance, and so forth. The second is about relationships and their success and so forth. The third, and again, in the competition with identity. And this third one is tackling a whole bunch of issues around autism. None of them is more or less serious than the others. They're all comedic because you can use comedy as a... I think comedy can support the most serious issues and sometimes is almost the only way of getting some of the most serious issues or getting some people to listen to discussion of some of those really serious issues. My comedy mentor was Tim Ferguson of Doug Anthony All Stars. Tim is now quite severely incapacitated with multiple sclerosis, but not so incapacitated he can't do, well, not stand up anymore, but he can do sit down. And he tells jokes about his multiple sclerosis. He tells jokes about incontinence and stuff. He says, make him laugh, make him cry, make him think. And when this guy's standing up talking about wearing a nappy and this sort of thing, and he's telling such a funny way, but you've got to feel for the guy, and then you've got to think about our attitudes and that sort of thing. Wow, the power of that is just extraordinary. And I just, if I can get a tenth of that power into my books, I'm very pleased.
Question 8, let's finish this up.
Well, I started off with a good short answer and then people paused, so I had to fill the gap.
All right, so the all three series, all the series have the same level of seriousness in them as the other, yeah, is what I'm hearing. Question 8, professionally, Don transitions away from his former life as a genetics professor to focus on the Hudson Project, while simultaneously opening the world's best cocktail bar. You took up writing at the age of 50, is that right?
I did.
Yep. Did your own experience...
I know, I'm incredibly young looking. Thank you, everybody.
I know. Did your own experience inspire and shape the storyline around Don's adaptability and decisiveness?
Yeah. Your own experience... I think the thing with writing is that if you seek to write about yourself directly, and it's not memoir, you'll get yourself into trouble. If you seek to deliver a philosophy, you'll get yourself into trouble because people feel they're being hit over the head. But if you just tell a story that means a lot to you, as honestly as you can, then your own values and your own experiences will find their way into that story unbidden. So I didn't set out to say, oh, Don's going to make a big change in his life. Lucky I've done that myself because I'll be able to use that. But as I wrote it, I'm sure that came into it.
So it seems like as you're writing this stuff, you had more and more hope that that's what would happen to you?
No, I don't think so. I think it was just as I was writing this stuff, it was Don's story, but my story helped me write it better, I guess. I mean, the previous book I'd written with my wife was Two Steps Forward. It was about midlife renewal. So it's obviously something that was on my mind. So it was always natural that would find its way into the book, that Don would start reinventing himself. The truth is you don't do that stuff consciously. You say, wow, that'd be a good idea if Don opened a bar, without thinking, I wonder where that came from. Don changing his life and getting out of what he was doing.
Good for Don. A cocktail bar where you use an app to order your drinks whilst avoiding meaningless or awkward social interaction. It's a brilliant concept. Is it not? How did you come up with the unique approach of the library?
Yeah, look, it just grew. It started off as Donna opening a bar, and it was originally going to be something quite different. And just it grew organically, where his sort of mentor, Min, who's his partner in the bar, and it's not going anywhere with the concept. In fact, the concept was all going to be about super chill drinks. And that is Don's concept, and his mate Amgad says, it's not going to fly, it's not going to work, this is not different enough. And his partner Min says, okay, I'm going to talk you through this. What sort of bar would you like? And it just came from Don talking about what sort of bar he liked. So I thought, okay. And so you've got this bar that I guess is autism friendly, and that ended up informing some stuff at the end of the story. But I know Yen Perkis, who many of you would know, as soon as they read that, they came back to me and said, I would so go to a bar like that. So maybe that's where the real profit from the book comes.
Last question.
Oh, wow. You skipped a few, didn't you? Come on, you skipped a few. Mate, no, well done.
We're running to schedule.
And never let them think otherwise.
In the Rosie books, Don breaks down the preconceived misunderstandings and stereotypes associated with autism, particularly around empathy and relationships. With this in mind, what would you like the readers to take away from reading the trilogy?
Look, I guess I'm being simplistic and obvious here, but I would say a better understanding of autism and a better acceptance of autistic people. And by acceptance, I don't mean tolerance. I mean real acceptance of that as a way of being and a legitimate way of being and a valuable way of being in our society. And I would like to be, because I'm ambitious, I'd like to be bigger than that. I would just like greater embracing of diversity, of different ways of being and living. I guess I've had my eyes opened here. My biggest research, I should acknowledge, the Autism West conference a year or so ago was a really important input to the Rosie result. I heard some of the key debates that were happening and so forth, and that was really useful input. But we've seen the other input. Sorry, drinking wine. It's being recorded, isn't it? People say, "Oh, great! Look at it. He has two drinks and he can't know what he was talking about." The other big input was Twitter, and I just watched a whole lot of debates play out on Twitter. I learnt a lot about that's mainly what I looked at. What was being discussed in the autistic community? What actually autistic people were saying and advocating for and so forth. And I started to understand something I hadn't understood before about how you could be, for example, without speech and still have a valuable life and want to be like that. Mm-hmm. My wife and I talked through some of these things. What if our child didn't have speech? Would we use ABA or whatever it might be? And I think both of our views have moved very considerably from what they were before. And for me, it's through the process of writing this book and interacting with people whose primary barrier to having a really good life is attitudes of other people and not something that's intrinsic to them.
So pretty much what Mandy said about how Autism West, what was the word you used? Does not...
We don't focus on the deficit.
Yeah,
which is what the psychiatric model has consistently done, and we're now moving. But look, even if you read something like the Cambridge scale and so forth, the questionnaire there's nothing there you'd want. Some of them might be a bit neutral, but being fascinated by number plates is not something that you say, "Wow, that's cool." But if you said fascinated by able to find patterns where others can't, whoa, that could be useful. You've just got a statistician or a fraud identifier or some, you've got valuable people there, but we don't have things that read valuable people. We have things that read problem, people with problems, people who are weird. So I'd like people to clearly you'd like people to move away from that kind of thinking, that sort of deficit thinking.
I can relate to that perfectly. Yeah.
And look, and one more thing, to be fair, in Chapter 8 of The Rosie Result, we had this debate that was really inspired by what I saw, or partly inspired by what I saw at Autism West, where we have the activist, Yin Perkis saw that and said, "You used me in there." And I said, "There might be a little bit of you in there, but there might be a little bit of Jackie Ten Hooten from Queensland. There might be a bit of a couple of other strong activists I've seen on Twitter and so forth in that mix." And on the other side, you've got the autism mum, who's often seen as a hate figure in the autism community. And I said, I want her, because I do it on my pages, I want her to be as fairly and as decently represented as possible. I want her arguments to be as clear on the page, not to just make them weak or anything like that. So you see both sides of an argument on the page there, and people can read that, not be preached at. My view is obviously, if you read the books and you're a diversity view, you can't, that's how the stories end up. That's clearly where I'm coming from. But I try to acknowledge that there are other ways of looking at the world as well.
All right, well... thank you so very much.
Well, thank you very much, Elias. Great job. We got through it.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to find out more or to make a donation, head to centreforstories.com.